Hello there. Welcome to Exploring the Eighth House. I am Miriam Schlossberg, and the topic today will be about death. Now, you may be feeling a bit squeamish after I said that, or you may be fascinated. Maybe you're feeling both squeamish and fascinated. Let's face it, death is part of life, and that is something that we just want to push away. However, we just can't. So, we are going to take a closer look at death today. And I have the honor of interviewing Dr. Judy Melinek and her husband, T.J. Mitchell, authors of Working Stiff. And before I bring them on, I'm going to introduce them briefly. Dr. Judy Melinek is a graduate of Harvard University. She trained at UCLA in medicine and pathology, graduating in 1996. Her training at the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner, New York, is a subject of her memoir, Working Stiff, which she co-wrote with her husband. Currently, Dr. Melinek is the CEO of Pathology Expert, Inc., and works as a forensic pathologist in Oakland. She also travels nationally and internationally to lecture on anatomic and forensic pathology, and she has been consulted as a forensic expert in many high-profile legal cases, as well as for the television shows ER and Mythbusters. Her husband, T.J. Mitchell, graduated with an English degree from Harvard and has worked as a screenwriter's assistant and script editor since 1991. He is a writer and stay-at-home dad, raising their three children in San Francisco. Working Stiff is his first book. So I'd love to take this opportunity to welcome Dr. Melinek and T.J. Thank you so much for being on the show. Hello there. How are you both doing?
We're great. Thanks for inviting us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for coming on. So, Working Stiff is a memoir about your job investigating how people die. But, as I stated before, death is generally a topic that most people are very uncomfortable about. So, what prompted you to write the book to tackle this topic?
The reason I decided to put together the notes about Working Stiff, which then I passed on to TJ and we actually worked on it together, was because forensic science shows were becoming incredibly popular. So while death is something that frightens people, at the same time it also fascinates them. And if you watch television, you will discover a plethora of these shows, CSI, NCIS, even true crime type series like 48 Hours or Forensic Science that focus on death scene investigation and crime investigation. Unfortunately, they gave a disproportionate view of what forensic scientists actually do. And because I was training in death investigation, I wanted to be able to give the public a better perspective of what my job is, what a death investigator really does, and why it's so important.
Okay, well, thank you very much for sharing that. So I just want to know as well, what are some of the common misconceptions that people have about forensic pathologists and death investigators?
The most common misconception is that we're somehow morbid or gruesome and that we're drawn to this field because of that morbid curiosity. Mm-hmm. The reality is actually quite different. Most people who are drawn to this field have been touched by death in some way and realize that by helping other people with their grieving and by getting people to talk about death during the investigative process and afterwards, we can help the public understand how to prevent death, and we can help the families come to terms with the death and help them with their grief. So that's a big part of the job. The other misconceptions come from what's popularly seen on television. So you see the forensic pathologist showing up at the crime scene in high heels, pointing at the object with a flashlight, even though it's pitch black out. So the general view of forensics is that it's done in the dark by very stylish people. And really, it's science. It's done by scientists, and we do it in bright lights.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people don't understand that forensic pathologists are medical doctors, that they're scientists. Mm-hmm. They don't single-handedly solve crimes, and their job is limited to determining cause of death and manner of death, which Judy can explain the difference between these two, but that's all that they do. They don't embalm bodies, and they are not police officers.
Yeah, we're not running around with guns and badges and getting confessions out of people.
Well, thank you for pointing that out, because I think a lot of people, I've heard people complain about that as well. So thank you for basically just saying that. I mean, that's the fact. It's very, very true that there's a lot of misconceptions about that, and thank you for just putting it out there. So I'm also going to ask, in Working Stiff, you describe how an autopsy is done and what a decomposed body looks like and even smells like. So did writing such gruesome stuff give you, how did you feel about writing all that?
I actually felt really surprisingly, I enjoyed writing the chapter on decomps, decomposing bodies.
Mm-hmm.
I was always dreading writing that chapter because that's part of what Judy does, and
mm-hmm.
she had grouped the decomps together into one chapter, and I was always worried that was going to be this trough in the middle of the book that nobody was going to want to read, and I certainly wasn't going to want to write. And it turned out that chapter
mm-hmm.
was scientifically the most fascinating. And as a human being and a layman, it gave me more perspective of what death means, because
mm-hmm.
it's not the immediacy of death anymore. It's
right.
exploring how the body returns to nature, returns to the soil cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
although it is disgusting on a visceral level, it
mm-hmm.
was fascinating on a philosophical level. And I actually really enjoyed writing the chapter on decomposing bodies.
Yeah, and I want to share a story with you if you don't mind. When I was 9 years old, I saw a decomposed body, and I was extremely traumatized, and it still traumatizes me to this day. I told my mother about it. She didn't believe me. So I actually want to, I mean, you can say that I've been touched by death in that way, and this is why I also want to bring more awareness out about it, because the fact of the matter is, death is something that, again, like I said before, people just don't accept, people don't want to talk about. They shove it under the rug. And I've read stuff online. I've read other books about how a body decomposes, and it's quite fascinating. I've wanted to read that stuff. It's quite fascinating. So I can see where you would actually enjoy writing about it.
Yeah, and also your experience was obviously shocking because
yes.
you were a girl and had no exposure to death. But Judy
That's
and her
right.
colleagues study decomposing bodies. There's
mm-hmm.
there's no
mm-hmm.
she can tell you that there's no really good scientific way to establish exactly how decomp goes,
mm-hmm.
and they do it largely by studying the actual bodies that come in.
Now, I'm going to ask you a question that's going to make a lot of people squeamish, but like I said, don't be. It's the reality of life. Death is part of life. How would you describe the smell of a body?
In Working Stiff, we describe it as what it would smell like if you've ever had a mouse or a rat die in the rafters of your house. And you'll get the sense of it, but not the overwhelming strength of it. It's a much stronger
mm-hmm.
smell, obviously, the larger the carcass is. And really the smell is oddly sweet in a sickingly sort of sour way. It's a kind of a sour, sweet smell, but
mm-hmm.
it is nauseating. And
mm-hmm.
sometimes it smells like really old garbage if you've had, you know, a compost bin, or it's an organic smell to some degree.
Right.
But it varies a lot. It depends on whether the body was decomposing in a dry environment versus a wet environment. If the body's fished out of the bay, for instance, it could even have a salty smell like the sea. So it does have some variability. Ultimately, when it comes to this issue of smell, you do get used to it over time. So it is something
mm-hmm.
that, when you first encounter it, it's overwhelming. Some people will actually put essential oils like grapefruit oil or pine-scented or menthol inside their mask so that it overwhelms the smell. But what I find is really your brain just kind of shuts it off after a while, and the more you work
right.
with decomposed bodies, the more you really stop smelling them. It's not like you don't smell it. It's just you
mm-hmm.
get a whiff, and this switch shuts off in your brain where you go, oh, okay, it's that, and you start breathing through your mouth, and you just don't smell it as much anymore.
And, of course, that smell is nauseating for a good reason. We are evolved to recoil
yes.
from rotting meat. and Judy and her colleagues get used to it, but the rest of us will still recoil from it, sure.
Right. One thing the police officers, one of the things that we write in Working Stiff is the police officers at the scene will boil coffee and actually burn it and boil it over in order to overcome that smell at a scene. If there's a body in an apartment down the hall, that's what they'll tell the neighbors to do. So that's one way of dealing with it.
That's good. That's very good to know, just in case, because I know there's been plenty of cases where people have died in apartments and nobody knows until it smells. So,
right, and it's actually a testament to their isolation. So it's we see it more frequently in happening in people who have lived isolated lives where they're not in contact with other people, and then their body only gets found when the neighbors complain, or sometimes when they've stopped paying the bills and the house gets sold.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. That would make sense. Now, I'm going to ask you, as a forensic pathologist, you frequently have difficult conversations with family members about death of a loved one. So what are the most difficult conversations you've had?
The conversations that are most difficult are the ones when the loved one is in denial. So as you know, the stages of grief also involve denial, the inability to kind of accept or understand what's going on with the death, either denying the death entirely or denying certain aspects of the death, for instance, if it was an accident or a suicide. So I will have family members not infrequently call me up either to give me information or to argue with me because they're not happy with the determination. In Working Stiff, TJ and I write about one case of a mother who could not accept the fact that her son had overdosed on medication, on drugs actually, that he had bought on the street and with a combination of medications too. And she really was in denial about it and started to come up with really wacky ideas about things that could have killed him, including bad sushi. She'd call me on a regular basis. And those conversations can be very difficult because on the one hand, it's frustrating not to get through to a person and not to be able to get them to understand what you're saying because of that denial, but on the other hand, you have such empathy for them because you know that they're suffering. So somehow helping them get from that stage of grieving to the next stage, or I don't know if I'll ever get them completely to acceptance, but just to move on to in their grief to a place where they're more accepting of what happened is part of my role as a medical examiner.
Wow. Okay. Well, thank you very much for sharing that. Okay, so I'm also going to ask you, how did you learn to talk to families about death? And is this something you've had formal training in?
The training for communicating with families came with the fellowship program. So Working Stiff is about my training at the New York City office, and frequently we would actually call families even before the autopsy, especially when they were objecting to the autopsy or they had questions about it. So we would be communicating them with them from the get-go about what we were doing, what the procedure was, how invasive or not invasive it was going to be, or if one was even needed at all. And then after we did the autopsy and we found out why the person died, we were encouraged to call the family members and give them the results, tell them what we found. And in some cases, we had contact information for families. In some cases, we didn't. But if we had it, we tried to reach out. Mostly, it's to help family members with that inevitable question that happens at the funeral, because they'll get the body back from the medical examiner, but sometimes our reports will be pending, where we're waiting for laboratory tests sometimes for weeks or even months. And in the interim, they're going on with their lives, they're having a funeral, and what happens? Family members or friends come to the funeral and ask, what happened? How did he die? That's the number one question that the family members get, and if all they have from the medical examiner is, we don't know yet, or we're waiting for the results pending, that's very frustrating. So it does help sometimes to call them up and give them an idea of what we saw at the autopsy, where the investigation is going, and to write a death certificate as soon as possible if we can.
Right, and talking to family members is an important part of Judy's investigative work, too.
Mm-hmm.
She did learn on the job how to be a death counselor, but she's also doing an investigation, and talking to the family is a very important part of that.
Right, absolutely. All right, and in Working Stiff, you write about your father's death and how, as a forensic pathologist, you went back to review his autopsy report. So I'm going to ask you, are suicide deaths different from other types of deaths you investigate?
Suicide deaths can be challenging because you're looking for evidence that the death was self-inflicted. So we really are looking for intent. What was going on in the person's mind at the time this act was committed? And it's very helpful for us if they leave a note, but people leave suicide notes in only about 10 to 20% in the largest study of cases. They don't leave them in all cases. So the remaining 80 to 90%, we have to infer their intent from the scene. And sometimes it's subtle things, like they'll take off their jewelry, their wedding band, and put it on the nightstand instead of wearing it when they wear it all the time, or taking their shoes off before they jump and lining them up just so, you're right against the wall in a very neat way. So that's more indicative of someone who's committing suicide as opposed to someone who gets into a struggle and gets pushed off a cliff, as opposed to that they intend to jump off that cliff. So those signs of preparations, how many knots they put into the rope that they put around their neck, the purchase of the rope, the receipts right there, the knives right there, all of the preparation, and how clean the scene is, that there's no sign of disarray, there's no sign of a struggle, all of that plays into how we interpret whether a death is a suicide. Now, that said, from the family's perspective, suicide is suicide as a manner of death has a lot more stigma than all the other manners. And by manner, I mean how we classify the death. So death can be natural if it's due to disease, but if it's due to some sort of injury, it's typically an accident, a homicide, or a suicide. And those are the choices we have. We don't really have many other choices. We could also do undetermined if we're not sure, but we, primarily choose between accident, homicide, and suicide. So the scene is what, in the majority of cases, pushes us towards a determination of suicide. And family members are often in denial, or they feel guilty about that determination, and they want us to reverse it or change it. So there is a struggle and a pushback sometimes. And then we have to go through the physical findings at the scene or even do a psychological autopsy to get into their mind, the mind of the deceased, in order to be able to support our contention that it's a suicide. In some jurisdictions, people will not determine suicide to within what we call reasonable medical certainty. They'll actually go beyond that to what we call clear and convincing evidence. They want a higher legal standard to be able to make that determination.
Oh, wow. Okay. Thank you so much for sharing that. Now, TG, I'm going to ask you a few questions if you don't mind.
Sure.
So during the time in your book, you were a stay-at-home dad to a toddler son. And now I understand that you two have three preteen and teenage children. So talk about the challenges, if you don't mind, of raising children in a household where your wife comes home and wants to discuss death over dinner or over family time or over just watching TV or something.
Yes, we got used to it over time. Judy, like anybody, comes home from work and wants to talk about what she did during the day, and what she did was autopsies and death investigation. So at first, it took a little getting used to on my part, and the children were very small, and we don't try to hide things from our kids, and they've grown up with death around the dinner table, so I think that they are more used to it than most people. It was helpful also to me as a stay-at-home parent that we learned in the course of Judy's working as a death investigator, even 2 years that she was in New York City, that the things that we worry about killing kids are not the things that really kill kids. Now, remember that she's not an ER doctor, so we don't see injuries that then don't lead to death. But still, all of the internet worries and the 6 o'clock news phobias about kids being in mortal danger don't turn out to be the things that actually cause mortal danger to kids. And for me as a parent, that was immensely liberating, really.
Wow, okay. Well, thank you very much for sharing that. And you know what? The thing is, I think it's very healthy to talk about death with your children as early as you can, because this way they're not afraid of it. When they're older, they accept it better. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not here to dog my mother, but she made a big mistake by not listening to me when I saw that horrific thing, that decomposed body, when I was 9 years old. So, I mean, it's very, very important to talk about death.
Yeah, sure. You can't, I mean, with most subjects with children, you can't hide things from them. You do have to learn how to talk to them about difficult subjects in a way that they can understand. And that's something that we've learned as parents around the dinner table, is how to explain the death of the day or the two deaths of the day or more that Judy mm-hmm. had done at work, how to explain how those can be instructive to the children in how to live their lives.
And that mm-hmm. said, I'm not, you know, disclosing any confidential information. It's more just the routine conversations that you have of what did you do today, and I talk about, oh, I did an overdose or we had a motor vehicle accident. And, you know, obviously children want to know more because they want to keep themselves safe. They want to know how to function in our world so that they're not injured. And so that's
Absolutely.
Really important to have those open discussions, because by studying death, as I do on a daily basis, or learning about it or questioning or reading about it, we learn how to keep ourselves healthy and protect ourselves.
Absolutely. Very, very good. And TJ, how about your relationship with death? Did writing about your wife's job change you in any way as far as that goes?
Well, it's been a surprise to me that I have become immersed in the world of death investigation. It's not something that I was ever really interested in. And I suppose, it has changed my attitude towards death, but not as much, I suppose, as I figured it would. The thing that Judy's work has most changed is my perception of what is really dangerous and what isn't. Just like mm-hmm. like what I thought was dangerous and not dangerous to kids, well, it turns out what is dangerous and not dangerous to you and me is also not what you see in the news or read about on the internet. It's heart disease. It's
mm-hmm.
a stroke. These are the things that kill most of us. And mm-hmm. I guess it's made me a little bit less afraid of the world. But no, I don't think that her job has changed my attitude towards death all that much. As I said about decomposing bodies, it has changed my attitude towards the human body after death. And I've gained
mm-hmm.
a lot more knowledge. And I guess mm-hmm. that has enriched my concept of what death and dying mean.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. And we're just about out of time, unfortunately. This has been very fascinating. I'm going to ask you one more question. How can people find you through social media and your website, and where can people buy your book?
Sure. The books are available on Amazon and at many bookstores, including Barnes & Noble and private independent bookstores, including your local bookstore, so you can always get it and request it there if they don't have it in stock. You can also get it as an audiobook through Tantor Audio and as an ebook through Kindle and other electronic book sellers. As for how to reach us online, we are both on Facebook and Twitter. I'm on Facebook as Dr. Judy Melanek, and we also post on Facebook, or primarily TJ posts as Dr. Working Stiff. And then mm-hmm. we have our Twitter handles at Dr. Judy Melanek and at TJ Mitchell WS.
And the full title of the book is Working Stiff, 2 Years, 262 Bodies, and the Making of a Medical Examiner.